Hello, a very warm welcome back to all of you. I do hope that you are finding the Gita Decoded to be as interesting as I am. I have learnt a lot and I hope you have too. Sister Denise has an extremely refreshing way and an insightful way of sharing her views and her churnings on what is one of India's most ancient scriptures. I just would like to tell you that neither Sister Denise or myself profess to be an authority on the Bhagavad Gita. What is shared here is simply our understanding, more specifically Sister Denise's understanding of this ancient scripture, and we invite you to think about it yourself and take what works for you. In today's episode, we will be looking at chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita, which chapter is entitled The Yoga of Renunciation of Action in Knowledge. Sister Denise, welcome back.
Thank you.
The topic itself is quite a mouthful, isn't it? Could you explain to us why yoga of renunciation of action in knowledge? It's one, two, three. It's four words there that, and all are significant. Mm.
Renunciation, generally speaking, in the conventional system of renunciation, is often called karma sannyas. That means renunciation of action. However, it's very clearly stated in the Gita that as long as you're in a body, you're breathing, that's already an action. So it is absolutely impossible to renounce action. But yet it's coming up as something desirable. One has to renounce a certain type of karma. There is this word inaction and the word non-action that you get in the translation here that we're working with. And in the Sanskrit, you have the word akarma. It comes in our teachings quite frequently. And it is said that God teaches the knowledge of karma, akarma, vikarma. Karma, sometimes we will say sukarma, pure karma, impure karma, and then akarma, we will call it neutral karma. So in the traditional interpretation of the Gita, the idea of neutral karma doesn't arise. And in Brahma Kumaris, we talk about neutral karma because of our understanding of what happens as a result of the Gita. The Gita is taking place at the time of the extreme of irreligion and unrighteousness, which we already have in book 4 around verse number 7. So the extreme means the end of the Kali Yuga, because if it's not the end, it's not the extreme. So the result of knowing the laws of karma is you become what's described in here as free from reincarnation. As long as you're here, you have a karmic account with matter. So therefore, you cannot avoid continued reincarnation. But there is a state of reincarnation where your karma and everyone else's karma is neutral karma. And in the traditional descriptions, this is called non-action. And there's another reason why it's interesting to call it non-action, because at a time when human society is in the what we call the Satyuga, the Golden Age, the whole society is operating like a very choreographed, preset ballet, if you will. And if you see a ballet, the people are dancing as they have to, not as they want to. It's fixed. And so therefore, it's another way of looking at non-action. You're acting, but you're not acting because of how you decide to act or you feel compelled to act, or there's no attraction-repulsion. So it's called neutral action. At this time, we're dealing with our karmic debts. And so we need to know, how did we get them? And what do we have to do about them? And this is why we're in the war, you see, because how did we get into this war? The Mahabharata war, which is the setting of the Gita, is a state of human society where everyone and everything is in conflict, and there is massive suffering. And so this is called the suffering of karma. And it's going down, 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 until there's just complete collapse of everything, complete destruction of everything.
Sister Denise, what one cannot ignore reading the Bhagavad Gita is that God is teaching Arjuna not how to shoot a bow and an arrow, but he's teaching him how to be.
Yes.
The entire conversation is him teaching him about himself and the internal war, not the external war. It's not teaching him, military secrets, military anything. It's teaching him how to be. That stays with one significantly.
Yes.
And so when he's saying fight, Arjuna, fight, he means conquer yourself, does he not, rather than someone else? Or am I misunderstanding it?
Definitely. Conquering yourself is a big part of it, but you're not in isolation. You're in relationship with the world. And there is a military component, there is a social component, there is an organizational component. There is this question that human life is about ambition and striving and achievement, you see. And a person who is really in their life, you know, achieving something is a very important part of it. So there has to be achieving, but then, as you rightly say, it's about being. How do you be with all of these energies of, you're dealing with a lot of conflict, you're dealing with a hostile, adversarial environment, you're dealing with your inner chaos, and you have to get somewhere, and where do you have to get is you have to have victory. What does victory mean? Part of it is you have to remain in a state of equanimity in the face of all the pairs of opposites. There's one kind of victory. Then you have another kind of victory, is you have to conquer your mind and your vacillating desires, another kind of victory. You also have to be recognized in society as a great person. That's another kind of victory.
True. Deep.
Oh. So it fascinates so many people for so many centuries.
And multi-layered. Sister Denise, at the beginning of chapter 4, we hear on page 2 the following words. After a long time here on earth, this yoga has been lost, Arjuna. Now, who has been or what has been on earth for a long time, and how has the yoga been lost?
A very important concept, this idea that God has to impart the knowledge of the Gita from time to time. You'll see a few verses later when he speaks about his promise, you know, the very, very famous 7th, 8th, 9th shlokas.
Do you want to read it for us?
Well, here there is a translation which, I mean, I would say it a little differently. But basically, it's whenever there is the destruction of righteousness and the rising of unrighteousness, it is then that I manifest myself. So it's definitely making it clear that the knowledge of the Gita is given at the time of the nadir of human experience, which is also corresponding to the Kali Yuga, you see. So after the Kali Yuga comes the Satyuga. Satyuga meaning the age of truth. We also call it the golden age. Kali Yuga, the age of darkness, the iron age, the age of ignorance. It's ideal moment historically to say, okay, we have reached hell. God, Deus ex machina, comes from somewhere else. You know, God is not a human. Comes from his region, his place where he dwells, into the human world, into the chariot of Arjuna, to explain to him the knowledge which causes him and those who follow him, or those like him, to be free and to become righteous. So therefore, it's a preparation for the change of age, the change of yuga, from the Kali Yuga to the Satyuga. And it says here, I come every age. But in Brahma Kumaris, we say, well, do you really come every age? Because if you do come every age, then the result of what you come and do would be the same every age. And what we see is that, in a way, the result of the Gita needs to be an age of absolute perfection and righteousness, which is the Satyuga. So it stands to reason to us that the age of the Gita has to be between the Iron Age and the Golden Age. And generally it's shown to be at the Copper Age. And the Copper Age is the period of time when the great religions are established: Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, Christianity, Jainism. All of these great religious traditions are set up, you know, about 2,000 years ago. And we also look at a 5,000-year cycle as the entire kalpa. So we would say it seems more realistic to say that he will come and do this at the cusp between kalpas rather than every age. So he establishes righteousness and destroys unrighteousness. Sometimes it is said he establishes dharma and destroys adharma, you see. So dharma can sometimes be called true religion, and adharma, anything which calls itself religion but which doesn't have the dharana, the practical signs of spiritual practice, the purity, the integrity, all of this.
Page 3 uses the word, this ancient yoga is today declared by me to you. What makes this yoga timeless?
I believe every soul has an encounter with God at some point. And that encounter is transformative, and it causes the soul to go from spiritually depleted to spiritually sound, full, restored to its original condition. And so that will leave a sanskar on the soul. A sanskar is like a very, very major imprint. God gives you knowledge. You become a righteous person from a relatively unrighteous person, and then you perform pure karma. Is a huge change in you, and then you appear in a righteous world and in your cycle of reincarnations. But the change is also so huge that you have to become completely free from all of your impurities, because when you come to God, you come in your worst condition, actually, out of all the changes that you pass through. So the effect of God on a person is to completely change them from the lowest to the highest, from the poorest to the richest, from the worst to the best, etc. the sanskar is indelible. It stays with the soul. When you reincarnate, you forget everything about your previous birth. And when there is a change of kalpa, a change of cycle, there's a huge break between the Kali Yuga and the Satyuga. It's not just a natural flow, it's a total break. And in that total break, I feel that you're going to forget everything, whatever had happened in the previous kalpa, and you're going to start as an absolute, you can say, a virgin soul. You know nothing of any war or any Mahabharat or anything like that, you know.
What I find touching about verse 3, and which is contained in line 3, it reads, "Since you are my devotee and friend," then God considers Arjuna to be his friend. That is so sweet. Oh, the reason that it touched me is because I heard one educator saying that all learning takes place through relationship. And so God first offers Arjuna his company, but it is not an ordinary thing, is it, God to call someone his friend?
There is the expression Khuda Dost, which comes from the Islamic tradition, God the friend. So this is one of the descriptions of God, the friend. Now, it was very interesting that you raised the question of learning through relationship. Because in Brahma Kumari's Raj Yoga, we are told relationship with God is everything. It is through relationship with God that you will be able to move forward. And so there are five significant relationships that we learn about. God is your father, your mother, your teacher, your guru, and your friend.
Covers all those five relationships, do they cover all the needs of the human soul?
I think they cover a lot. Of course, there are other relationships. Your lover, your lawyer, your doctor. you have other relationships, but these are very significant. And I think there's a very deep emotional bond in those relationships, which means there's a huge influence. And there's an influence on the heart, because there's an absolute loyalty involved in those. And the other thing is, these are non-threatening relationships. I mean, maybe the guru is a bit threatening, but otherwise, you know, your mother, your father, your friend, you completely open up to those. And I think what you have in the Gita with Krishna and Arjuna talking to each other as friends, all of the awe and fear and trepidation that one would have if one thought, you know, oh, God is in the same room with me, I've got to be really scared here, you know, because there is that aspect of God being so almighty, so scary, that you can't just open up. So I think the thing that is in these early chapters of the Gita, where Krishna is the friend, the aspect of God as the terrifying, all-knowing, almighty authority is so merged that it's possible for Arjuna to be really ingenuous and say, you know, I need to understand these things, I don't understand these things, to feel free to argue.
The next thing that struck me is, this secret is supreme indeed. Now, the multi-million dollar, pound, euro question, yen question is, why is truth a secret?
I think partly because, you know, people consider themselves bodies, and the truth is, you're not a body. Sometimes people say, yeah, I know I'm not a body, but then what do they know about being a soul is incomplete. Like, sometimes people say, okay, the body is prakriti, the soul is Purush. Purush means a man. Men have souls. Women don't. And so they make a discrimination biased against women on the grounds that a woman is not a Purush. You know, she might have, she can be a Prakruti. Okay, we can use her as a field in which to plant seeds and get children. And so that you do get angles on women, which is a very strong gender bias based on this interpretation of the soul being male. In other places, and also in Brahma Kumari's Raj Yoga, it is said all souls are male. Truth is difficult for people to comprehend because of the body consciousness, because of identifying with the body as a male or a female. It's impossible for people in body consciousness to imagine that a soul incarnates sometimes as a woman, sometimes as a man, and even then that it will exchange genders more or less every time it reincarnates. If you're a man, generally speaking, you don't like the idea of your next incarnation will be as a woman, because they don't like women.
Who doesn't like women?
Well, women are very nice as playthings, and people who cook and look after the children, but they have a second-class status in society because it's, on the whole, a male-dominated world. It's biased towards the males and against the females. If you are in a female body, the odds are stacked against you. In some cultures, far more than in others. Some cultures are much more egalitarian, but especially in the East, it's very patriarchal. What the knowledge of the soul says is, okay, the soul is male, not from the point of view of having a male body, but from the point of view of being Purush, and the body is Prakruti, the material. So whether your body is male orientation or female orientation, bodies are Prakruti, they're objects, they're material things. And the soul is the Purush, you see, whether it's in a female body or a male body. And this is very upsetting type of truth for people, very upsetting. Then the other thing is color. The darker the color is considered the more impure the soul, you see.
So oh, does that mean I'm in trouble then, Sister Denise?
Well, a lot of people are in trouble, but...
A lot of people are in trouble. Continents of people are in trouble.
Continents of people are in trouble. And you know, the whole foundation of race discrimination is to be found in this description that the purer the soul, the lighter it is. And the more impure the soul, the darker it is. But then they take that on a bodily level, that light-skinned means better quality, darker skinned means worse quality. But if you look at the practical reality across all the different races, religions, etc., there are some people who are very full of virtue and other people who have not so much virtue, and it doesn't have anything to do with the religion, the gender, the color. There's nothing to do with it. But because people take a spiritual concept and interpret it in a material way, it has created these angles of preconception.
Yes, it's just fascinating that that which is universal and the truth is a secret. I just couldn't wrap my mind around that.
And even if you tell somebody, they won't get it, or they won't hear it. Mm. Or they'll block it out, or something like this. Somebody who can hear it, it's just going to blow their mind, you know. So then you have to reset everything in your thinking. And every time you hear another truth, you have to again reset. And not very many people are willing to do that because it is very disturbing to your arrangements inside your being.
Because if you're living the life of illusion, hearing the truth can be your worst nightmare.
Oh yes, oh yes. Because it calls into question everything about you, whatever it is that you held to be true, and your principles and everything. All of a sudden, something comes along and it says, no, it's not like that. You have to reassess everything. Who wants to do that?
Okay, Sister Denise, we have to say goodbye to you for now. And imagine that. We started on chapter 4 and we did not get past the third shloka. So it just shows you and myself that there is so much of depth within this chapter that is going to take us a lot longer to go through than I first anticipated. But I do hope that you were able to glean what Sister Denise was saying, that one should understand the Bhagavad Gita from not a superficial perspective, but from a very deep perspective, to really understand what God's message is to mankind. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you for episode number 17. Take care. Goodbye.